Forever Dog.
Welcome to another episode of Best Show Bests, the greatest hits of the best show, with me, your host, Tom Sharpling. If you like what you hear, make sure you join us every Tuesday night on Twitch at 6 p.m. Pacific for a brand new episode of the Best Show, featuring callers, celebrity guests, live music, and plenty of surprises. Enjoy! Do I bring the hotline up or is it up? Oh, here we go. I got it. Okay. Here we go.
Famous person on the line.
Famous person on the line.
Here we go! Here we go!
I'm being told there's a famous person on the line, and to go to the line with the famous person. This is so exciting. Welcome to the best show, Jeff Tweedy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm
Thanks
good.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for coming on the show. This is so exciting.
The music was really loud on my phone.
Hold on a second.
The Pet Shop Boys was the loudest I think I've ever heard waiting music. That was pretty amazing.
In a good way or a bad way? Because heads will roll over here. If you say bad way, people are getting a cardboard box and they're going to put their plant in it and they're out.
It was exciting.
There you go. Okay, that's a good one.
I think that's good.
You're all safe for now. If you do anything.
It really got me amped up.
Oh, God, you're all fired up. Well, get ready to get fired down. I don't know what else to say. After you got fired up, I'm going to fire you down now, Jeff Tweedy. Now,
Well, I figured that's why I'm here.
Now, it's so exciting to have you here. The new album, Cruel Country, is so great and is at such what is it like to be this far in with a band? You are 20, coming up on 20 years in now, right? With Wilco?
More like 25.
Really?
I think.
Wait, 94?
Yeah. More like maybe even longer than that. I'm pretty bad with math here. I think that first Wilco records like
no, you're right. Oh my god,
27 years.
Oh, I'm so bad with. I'm so dumb. Oh my god, it is. Yeah. Look, I gotta say, look, math.
No, you're not dumb.
No, I am. Look, you can call it 27 years. 27 years in. I'm so bad with math. I mean, my mind. Look, first of all, in my mind, I still think it's 2002 somehow. Like I'm always shocked when suddenly it's like, hey, you know, that record came out 14 years ago. I'm like, no, that came out 2 years ago. But that's
on me. It doesn't work the same way it did when we were younger. I don't know why. I mean, we're further away from my first record than we were from like Elvis.
Yeah,
that's when we first started making.
That is like the crazy thing when people are like, hey, you know, if they were to make Dazed and Confused now, it would be about 1997. And I'm like, no,
right.
That's horrifying.
Yeah. That's not fair.
Well, it's more dramatic then because you dropped one of the best records in the band's entire catalog 27 years deep.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, thank you. I don't know what to say. That's very sweet.
Because the records all have different vibes, different feels, and different attitudes to them. When does that kind of reveal itself when you're the one making the records? Like, when do you get a feel for what the record is going to look like or sound like in the process?
I mean, I really don't know. The process is kind of like, I just start making stuff. I just start writing songs. I'm kind of always writing songs, but when we start working on a record, we just start kind of instinctively playing the songs that sound like something we were excited about trying to record. And at some point, it happens every time that it just starts to have, it's like we discover it. It's like not really looking for it to be the same thing or not the same thing. It always ends up being a little bit different because we use this process of recording that just is more about finding the record than it is about setting out to make a type of record, you know? Mm-hmm.
And there's some tipping point in the process where suddenly it's like, huh, this is where it looks like we're going to be living with this one.
Yeah. I mean, like we'll do, for example, for Cruel Country, we had been recording all of this sort of art pop material for, you know, since before the pandemic. And when we finally got to play together in the studio again, we started working on some of that music again. And at some point, just to have a new song to sing, or it just felt like this was so exciting to be in the studio together after not spending time in the studio for such a long time. Mm-hmm. It felt like kind of urgent to have like a new song to sing or each day. And the songs that were easiest to learn and felt the most immediate were these like kind of country songs and folk songs that I've been writing. And so we started playing those. And I don't know, they just started sounding like they belonged on a record together.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It just started, the other stuff just stopped being, I really think that other stuff is going to be great when we, you know, when we get it out and finish, you know, it's in a whole nother record that's kind of almost done. But I think that this stuff just felt more like, not very self-conscious, very comforting to us to just kind of play these more traditional song shapes. I don't know why, it's just the same thing that always happens. It just became this thing that we were reacting to more than we were, felt like we were directing it, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And just the sheer, because you have been on one of the all-time prolific streaks over the last bunch of years where you can't shut that faucet off, that songwriting faucet. So
it's a great comfort to me to make stuff up, you know. I love writing songs, and I'm kind of constantly writing songs. So yeah, I think that it's nice to have places to put them. You know.
Yeah. How do you kind of feel like this one's good for Wilco? This one is one I could maybe do solo. This is like, because you have so many avenues or potential destinations for the songs. When do you know which one belongs where?
Well, the ones for a while now, the ones that I feel like I could put across by myself with just an acoustic guitar, even if I put other instruments on them, I kind of think of those as songs that I could put on my solo records because I don't have to rely upon a whole band being there to kind of communicate the song. But then a lot of songs that are written like that ended up on this record. But that used to be the kind of the rule of thumb. This one was just kind of like, hey, why not play some of these songs with Wilco and everybody in Wilco? Really, it's kind of material that we haven't really tackled in a long time, this more country flavored angle or something. I don't know. It seemed pretty exciting for everybody, including me, to hear, you know, Nels Klein play dobro. You know, just the way the band plays together, it just sounds so nice to me to hear these songs like that.
It's so great, and there's such a great feel to the whole record, and it's kind of, you're kind of hitting a sweet spot on it where it's beautiful, and then it starts to get a little fractured, and then it gets beautiful again. It's just like, it really, look, I'm not gonna blow smoke here, but it's just, I kept picking up on like a almost like a sister lover vibe in spots on the record, just like that brand of beauty. Well,
I mean, that's a huge component of our vocabulary. It's like a Venn diagram of what everybody in Wilco likes. It's probably right in the center, like that kind of I don't know, whatever scratches that itch, that kind of record, this Sister Lovers, mm-hmm. you know, it's like it's broken and I don't want to fix it kind of sound, you know?
Yeah. Now, how?
It's like a,
okay, sorry.
Something important about the whole band being able to play together with some vulnerability, which is hard for, you know, it requires a lot of trust and, you know, emotional kind of connection for a band to play with that kind of, freedom mm-hmm. from wanting it to be perfect, I guess, you know, but just allowing everybody to sound emotionally invested, all the instruments even, you know?
Yeah. And now you said in your first book that everybody recording together can kind of, and taking advantage of the immediacy of the live aspect of something in terms of recording can kind of limit the tinkering and the maybe fixation on pedals and whatnot. It just feels like this is one of those records where you can almost feel the relief that you all are getting to share this together.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, after so many years, being kind of an established band, and it's a band of people that can all play their instruments pretty well, and we have so much gear at the loft, it can be a little bit overwhelming sometimes, like where you're not really creating, you're making decisions, you know, mm-hmm. like you're just deciding from an infinite set of parameters which ones you want. And I think you always, one of the parts of the process that I think we always have to rely upon is limiting that, you know, so that you can be more creative, not just making decisions, but making a connection with a smaller set with just a smaller palette or just a smaller set of parameters. And, mm-hmm. and yeah, it is a relief. I think I'm much more comfortable in that mindset than I am within the computer age, looking at Pro Tools or things that a lot of people, I guess, feel really comfortable using. I just feel like it's almost too infinite sometimes. And it's like having the whole English dictionary in front of you to pick out a sentence or something like that. I kind of don't need that. I just need the words that are coming to me to mm-hmm. not be impeded by choices, you know?
Yeah. You just, there, it ultimately kind of runs counter to the actual objective, which is to make music.
Right. I just think all the, like so many of my favorite records were made with just the most ridiculously minimal, I don't know, like Suicide's first album, or, you know, it's just like just a couple of elements, or Nick Drake, Pink Moon, or something like that. There's so many records to just rely upon such a simple palette, Wire, Pink Flag, things like that. And we're a six piece band, so we're never going to have that kind of austere, really disciplined, minimal approach. But we can get closer to it by being somewhat conscious of the fact that we don't, I don't know, it kind of helps our creativity to be, just draw focus a little bit more on a few things.
Sure, sure. Now, one of the fun things in you've written two books, they're both outstanding. I can't recommend them highly enough. One is a memoir, I guess it's fair to say. Let's go so we can get back. And then a couple of years ago, you wrote a book on how to write one song, which kind of is you exploring the process and It's funny how it ends up being a memoir in and of itself while having ostensibly a different purpose, but you still are telling stories about yourself through the journey of explaining how you write songs. But one of the things that's so interesting.
By the way, I just started your book and I've been really enjoying it.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh, that's the nicest thing I ever heard in my life, honestly. That I reread the first book to get ready to talk to you, and I was like, oh no, I think we have things in common that are not the fun things to have in common. So you will be like, yeah. Oh, I got locked up in one of those places too. I think if you stick with the book, you'll have some of that to look forward to.
Hi, everybody. Tim Heidecker here to let you know about our latest episode of Office Hours Live.
Office Hours is great fun.
With the great John Early and Theda Hamill.
Very handsome.
Thank you. They're here to talk about their new movie, Stress Positions. And we just had a wonderful time. There was a lot of laughter and joy. Don't believe me? Well, listen for yourself on the podcast app of your choice. You're not going to want to miss a second. That's at Office Hours Live at the podcast app of your choice.
Bum, 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 bum.
I love Vic and Doug, and I love drinking my wine.
But one of the things I was so thrilled by was that I couldn't have related to more was the kid at the grocery store reading Cream magazine and doing everything you can to hold on to as much information as you could get while you're at the grocery store.
Yeah, absolutely. Such a piece of cosmic luck that those magazines existed at that time. I don't know. I just feel I would have felt really lost, I think, without that window into a world outside of my immediate environment, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's so interesting, the way music has, the consumption of music has changed is like, back then, I don't know if like people growing up now realize it was like everything was presented as a fight, basically. Like if you Cream magazine, you had to pick between Led Zeppelin or The Clash.
Like, right.
I mean, I remember the letters sections were right. they were saying like, pick a side, kid.
Yeah, I remember this really brief period where we were insisting to our friends that they couldn't listen to Neil Young.
That's
because he was a filthy hippie.
Yeah, but that's so funny. That's just like you're trying to at that point you're trying to figure out who you are at that point. And
right. It was just such a way to, to form an identity around records. It's a really bad strategy for identity forming, by the way.
Oh, and it doesn't help when you don't necessarily have the money to go get the records yet either. Like, you're just kind of reading about them. And I would just go to the library. I'd read old Rolling Stones and I would just like be writing things down. And then it would just be like, well, I don't know where I'm going to hear this stuff necessarily, but I had that same, when you say in your book that you nailed what Gang of Four sounded like before hearing them, that was the story of my childhood.
Absolutely. And like the writing at that time really had to do a much better job of conveying those things. Like, what's it sound like? Almost nobody writes about that now because you sound like an idiot when everybody can just listen to it for themselves. But I miss that. I miss that about rock writing. I miss when people had to be kind of imaginative and and explain it to somebody like they would never hear it, you know?
Absolutely. It really, it carried so much of the water for a young music fan at that point to just, when I would go to a record store, I was just going in and it was like all of that research. It was time to start for it to start paying off when I'm at the record store and just trying to find these things, find right. imports and it just is such a strange, you know, the strangest one to me, you know, the iconography of bands. And you think about, like, I used to look at those Grateful Dead records and you see a skull with a lightning bolt running down the middle of it. And then you see a skeleton with roses, a wreath of roses around its head. And it's just like, then you hear the Grateful Dead and it's just like, well, this shouldn't sound like that. Like, this doesn't match those images.
Yeah. I mean, it's like there's such a. I'm just reminded of, like, I think that Black Flag was like a popular band across the country before anybody had ever heard them. It was based on their flyers and their logo alone. Yeah.
It's so funny you say that. It's like T-shirts were like news bulletins as much as anything, where you would just see a Husker Du shirt or especially a Black Flag shirt. You see those bars and it's just like, oh, I gotta hear what that sounds like. But look, for me, to be fair, I was just kind of like, that scares me. I don't know if I can handle that just yet.
Yeah. I think I saw a Minor Threat shirt before I ever heard of a Minor Threat record. Yeah. Lots of things like that. Yeah. But I hear what you're saying about the Grateful Dead. And I guess what reminded me is like around the same time, and those records had existed for a long time, but I remember being really afraid of a lot of the punk rock kids in St. Louis at the Black Flag shows I would go to. And then one of like the main key guys that seemed like the leader of the St. Louis punks, I went to see Black Flag one time and all of a sudden he was wearing a Grateful Dead shirt. It was controversial.
Yeah.
It was a huge shock to all of us.
Yeah, it's such a funny thing, the lines that were drawn, and now like young people talk about music and it's just infinitely healthier to just be like, I just remember I like this and I like this and I like this. And the walls are down between the band versus band. Those things are just gone now.
Yeah, my like watching my kids grow up has been really, wonderful that they don't have to do that. They're like, I think it existed a little bit when they were really young. Like there were some lines in the sand being drawn around Justin Bieber,
mm-hmm.
but like between boys and girls, it seemed like at the time, but they liked Justin Bieber. We went to see the Justin Bieber movie in the theater and both of my kids had haircuts that almost looked like Justin Bieber. And we were in an audience with entirely teenage girls or preteen girls, and they were really, really, getting a lot of attention.
No, that sounds like the greatest day ever to be a preteen or teen. Just like you're just Bieber adjacent at that point, and that's enough.
It was a coincidence. The haircuts just happened to be how they had their hair, but they did look like they were at the time. They did kind of, and we walked into it not expecting anything. And when we were, it was pretty obvious that they looked like they were trying to look like Justin Bieber at the time. So it was a sweet memory.
Oh, that's amazing.
But I don't know.
I'm not gonna take much more of your time. I want to ask you a couple more questions, and then I want to ask you we got a thing here, Jeff, where we're trying to we need scoops. We just need scoops.
Okay.
I'm not gonna hit you over the scoop yet, but I want to ask you, what is your relationship to influences Ben, since you've been, you're so deep into putting out music and creating music, how has your relationship with consuming music and consuming potential influences changed over the years?
I feel like I'm the same as when I was a kid. I have a pretty just insatiable appetite for records and art and books and things like that. I just have I have the resources to kind of feed it more than I did when I was a kid, and certainly technology allows this kind of crazy. I don't know. Every Friday when records come out, I can sit and listen to records all day long and just sample. I feel like when I worked at a record store, it was fun on the release days, because you just get to kind of open up all the records and check everything out. And we get to open up at least one copy of almost everything that would come out. And mm-hmm. Now you can get to do that with, hundreds of records at a time if you want. And I kind of do. I kind of just like to listen to stuff and read stuff until I can't take it anymore. Uh-huh. That's been the same as when I was a kid. I kind of feel like I have to answer the challenge or something and make something. And it's kind of the way I feed this creative impulse that I have.
That's great, because it keeps you, because so many people, it's the easiest place in the world to end up is when people are I'm all full up. I get it. I got enough.
You go through phases like that with old records that you've listened to a lot where you're just like, I'm over that. But then, I still listen to a fair amount of comfort food, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it, things that I know I'm going to love.
Is there anything that has lost its power for you over time? Because I've had that happen with certain things. It's like, look, when I was 15, I started collecting Beach Boys records, and it's been a long time, me and the Beach Boys together. And I just think I might have squeezed everything out of them that there is to squeeze. The records are still as great as they ever were, but just for me, I think I drained them. Is there anything like that that you feel like you just doesn't move the needle like it used to?
Not off the top of my head. I think I went through a period like that with the Clash at some point. Mm-hmm. And if I'm being completely honest with myself, there's maybe only one record that really retains the same feeling. And I mean, it's London Calling, which is kind of unassailable, but the other records that I've loved so much when I was younger, I don't know if they're just recorded in a way that I can't really listen to anymore or something, but I guess that's the first thing that comes to my mind is just like having a little bit of its luster faded.
Yeah. I mean, it's strange because I'll go on runs with certain people where I'll just go on a deep dive with certain things. And I know it's like when I'm done with it, it's like, well, I'm probably not going to listen to The Who like that for 5 more years. But then whenever the itch shows back up again, then it's like, well, I guess this is where we're going. But some of them, I just feel like, okay.
Now that I say that though, I will say that, not long after the pandemic started and everything was shut down, Sammy, my youngest son, had left college and left all of his stuff at college. And so at some point, Spencer and Sammy and I got in a van and drove to Yonkers, to Sarah Lawrence University, to get his dorm and packed up and bring it back to Chicago. And we did it in 48 hours. We drove there and drove back. And one of my favorite memories from that trip was on the last, it was middle of the night, last maybe 3 hours of the drive. I asked the kids if they'd ever really listened to Sandinista all the way through.
Yeah,
and they said, of course not. Mm-hmm. You know, they heard it and they knew stuff off of it, but they hadn't listened to the whole thing. So we listened to it with basically saying, no skipping ahead, no nothing. We're going to listen to the whole record all the way through. And that's probably the first time I'd done that since I was a teenager probably a teenager. And that was just the landscape, you know, like foggy highway driving, and that record is just so otherworldly. So I don't know. I just felt like I had to add that after dumping on the Clash, because it was beautiful.
Well, that's amazing. Sandinista is like this weird thing that fell from the sky that it's like, do you want to try to figure out what that thing is? It almost doesn't count in a way.
There's nothing else that sounds like it. I don't know if any other record that sounds like it or creates it feels like it's from the same universe even.
Yeah, and it's funny how you don't see many other people putting triple albums out after Sandinista. Like that, I think they were the last ones through that door.
Yeah, they shot that out. Not going to happen.
No, I think it's now just a couple. I'm going to ask you a few rapid fire questions here. What's the most you ever paid for a record?
I mean, I handled a lot of really expensive records working in the record stores in St. Louis, but I don't.
The money down on the counter.
Maybe. What's that?
Is you slapping your money down?
Yeah. I'm not really that much of a record collector in terms of like just having to have like pristine copies of rare records. I just think maybe the first thing that comes to mind is I think I spent around $300 on a Billy Nichols record not that long ago, Love Songs.
Okay. That's right in that healthy range of upper register though. $300. And you know it hurts a little bit, but you got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have many friends that wouldn't even be a blip.
No. Yeah. Me and you both on that one, where it's just like, it's like, well, no, I kind of like, my car also, still, and we're getting into either or.
I've always
territory.
Been much more interested. I want to have the music. I don't care if it's on CD or cassette or record or streaming. I don't know. I just like, I want to just hear the song mostly. You mm-hmm. know?
Well, who have you never seen a single movie by?
I mean, probably someone I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen a Lord of the Rings movie.
Okay.
Does that count?
That definitely counts.
Probably seen a Peter Jackson movie.
Yeah. That's a good one. Let's see here. Snickers or Milky Way?
Snickers. I once bet my wife not that long ago that I could lose weight just eating Snickers, and I lost that bet.
Yeah, no, I could have answered that one for you, Jeff. They're not good for you.
I thought that I felt so full after eating one. I thought I could just eat three a day.
Uh huh.
So I bought a case. I bought a case of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work.
It didn't work. No, look, you're talking to somebody who looks at the candy aisle, and I'm like, oh, there's a Payday bar. That's like a healthy candy bar because it's just peanuts, but they're peanuts glued together by sugar.
Well, now I don't eat sugar at all, actually. So that was part of my experiment, and I failed so so spectacularly that it actually put me off of sugar. So,
well, that's what got you there. More power to you. I am not. I'm not at that point yet.
I'm powerless over sugar.
Yeah. Well, me too. Now, I want to ask you about one apocryphal thing. When you were in Uncle Tupelo, did you throw the Nevermind cassette out the window, or is that some apocryphal story?
I think that happened. That's my memory of it. I remember it just being compared to Whitney Houston in our van. Mm-hmm. I just thought that it sounded so produced to our ears. And I don't know. Yeah. I feel like, you know, it's hard to tell anything, whether or not my memories are really, I don't trust my memory, to be honest with you, about okay. almost anything from a certain period of time in my life. But that is a memory that I would like, if I was on a lie detector, I think would pass.
You'd have to, yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. It sounded like Foreigner at that point. Like, it was just big.
It sounded exactly like Boston.
literally sounded like Boston. Guitar?
It just
needed Tom Schultz with one of his weird guitar little pedal things or whatever he had to close the deal.
We were idiots and kind of purist about a lot of things, and you know, like, it's sort of still coming out of that damage we were talking about drawing lines, you know, choosing sides about ridiculous, like, arbitrary things. And I don't know, for whatever reason, like insecurity, competition, competitiveness, whatever it was, it just felt like, you know, it just felt like bullshit to us.
I remember being so bummed out when I heard Goo, and I was like, what are they doing? Why does it sound like this? Like, I was just so... like, I couldn't understand why they would do this after Daydream Nation. I was like, why is it just so clean sounding? And it took me years to finally put it in its proper place. I was just mad at that album forever. And everybody was on there. It really was an us versus them kind of time. Now, final thing I'm going to ask you, and then I'm going to play a bumper here. Hold on. Oh.
Come on. Give us a scoop.
We need scoops. It's all we've... this is the new currency. It's a scooped-based economy. Any kind of scoop you could throw our way?
Jeez.
Please give us a scoop.
I don't think I have a scoop that's going to help you.
Doesn't have to be a big scoop.
Scoop-based economy. Doesn't have to be a big scoop.
Could be one of those taster scoops when you go to an ice cream place and they give you a little sample. That's still a scoop.
Sample scoop?
A sample scoop.
Well, I am working on another book. I don't know if that's a scoop. It might be out there a little bit. I am getting ready to, I'll probably have another book out this time next year or a little bit later.
Well, that is an amazing scoop. What type of book is it?
Well, I think it's kind of somewhere between the two books I've written. I think it's maybe more, a little bit more fractured memoir, maybe an essay form, along with some commentary about, I was just kind of trying to pick about 50 songs that I feel like made me who I am to some degree, and write about them, you know, kind of like the songs in my life or whatever. I think that maybe the songs I feel like I've learned the most from, but I was going to call it Get Well Soon, Everybody.
Amazing. That, look, I cannot wait. I love, As much as I love your music, I love the two books you wrote, and knowing there's another one coming makes my week. So that's exciting. And
awesome.
And I want to thank you for calling in and being a part of the show. And everybody should check the album out, Cruel Country. It's so great. And thank you, Jeff Tweedy.
Well, nice finally talking to you, Tom. Really, you know, I feel like I've known you for a long time. So thanks for the book and nice talking to you.
Oh, man. Same here. And I will see you down the road somewhere.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye. Well, how about that? We got the scoop.
The Best Show is produced in partnership with the Forever Dog Podcast Network. The show is hosted by Tom Sharpling and features John Worster, Michael Lisk, Jason Gore, and Pat Byrne. The show is produced and written by Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, Michael Lisk, Brett Davis, John Worster, and Tom Sharpling. The Best Show is executive produced by Tom Sharpling, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Co-executive produced by Jason Gore and Pat Byrne, segment producer Michael Lisk. The show is engineered and mastered by Andrew Gleason and Wesley Knapp. Graphic design, video editing, and social media by Brett Davis. Website and technical support by Martine Sellis. And the show is recorded at Forever Dog Studios in Los Angeles. Support The Best Show on Patreon over at patreon.com/thebestshow. And follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Best Show for Life. That's Best Show 4 Life. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.